Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Every night person knows how hard it can be to get up and moving at 7 in the morning. Likewise, morning people often struggle to stay up for a late night on the town. Beyond these issues, our body clocks really do make a difference in how we live our lives. Dr. Matthew Edlund, director of the Gulf Coast Sleep Institute, believes that our body clocks affect us in every aspect of our lives. Dr. Edlund is the author of The Body Clock Advantage, Finding Your Best Time of Day to Succeed in Love, Work, Play, and Exercise. I spoke with Dr. Edlund from his office in Sarasota, Florida, and asked him to tell us about the different implications that body clocks have in our lives and in our society.
How we choose our mates, what jobs we like, when we get up in the morning, what we're good at, how our drugs work, when we enjoy sex. It's kind of hard to find things that aren't affected. It turns out that 24-hour clocks are a basic design element in all of biology on Earth. You can look at paramecia, you can look at amoebae, you can go down to the animals in the darkness of the Pacific Trench, and they're still following 24-hour cycles. That's basically how we all evolved.
So that presumably is related to the rotation of the Earth.
Absolutely. The idea is that you have the organism prepared for night and day, for the changes of environment in night and day. And it turns out that gets generalized to just about everything we do.
Well, how about some examples then? You mentioned in finding mates. How does that work?
Basically, the population tends to split into larks or morning people or owls and or night people. And what typically happens is that owls will often tend to meet owls. I've yet to find a jazz musician who's a morning person. And sometimes owls will consort with larks. And strangely enough, there are higher divorce rates when larks marry owls than when larks marry larks or owls marry owls. We have different times, and we tend to meet different people based on the times that we're seeing them.
Well, what is the way that those times that an individual's body clock is established?
A lot of it's genetic. Some people are a lot more able to adjust to different shifts and different times than others. But basically, larks and owls are primarily born. And as we get older, as we go from, say, 20 to 70, our body clocks tend to get a little earlier, which is why you'll find grandma waking up at 5 in the morning and why older people are often going to bed earlier. It's because our body clocks shift with age.
Why is that?
Why do they shift with age?
Yes.
I wish I knew. It's just one of the things that happens with time. It may have something to do with just the primary time oscillator, which is in the brain. There's a lot of things that happen with aging, and this just seems to be one of them. Interestingly, the ability to remain on time, for example, to wake up within 5 minutes of an alarm, is pretty consistent even as we get much, much older. These things are very well conserved.
But isn't that ability something that is trained? A 6 or 7 year old would have a much more difficult time doing that than a 20-year-old.
Not necessarily. If you have a 6 or 7 year old going to bed at the same time, getting up at the same time, they're probably going to be able to have pretty close timing, even to much older people. It's just a matter of whether they're following their routine or not.
So the routine habituates the individual?
Absolutely. By the time infants are 3 or 4 months old, they start having regular 24-hour rhythms. Having a kid for the first few months is often something that will drive parents crazy. But as time goes on, kids do develop similar times to adults.
You mention in your book a difficulty of blind people, that they don't have that same 24-hour rhythm.
That's a fascinating thing, because it turns out that in the last few months, researchers have found what's effectively a sixth sense. There are actually cells in the eye called retinal ganglion cells that pick up light, but not visually. They pick up light and send it to the body clock centers. They're there to effectively average out light, so we'll know what 24-hour cycles are. Now, about half of blind people follow 24-hour rhythms, but the other half don't. And the thinking is that that half lack those special cells with the receptors for light that don't go to visual light in the brain.
Has there been anything to distinguish the lack of those cells in people who are born blind versus people who become blind after having had sight?
I don't know, because the research is so new. There are differences in many cases, but it's mostly a question of how much cell loss there is rather than how. It really is a matter of whether there's some receptors left in the eye or not.
How is that determined, whether those receptors are in the eye?
You mean whether they live or not?
That's right.
I don't know.
In a blind person, is it something that happens in an autopsy, or is it something that can be determined on a living individual?
Since they've only been able to identify the cells in the last few months, I really can't tell you. It's actually exciting research. It's showing that there's a whole bunch of receptors in people that are there just for body clocks. Turns out, for example, in birds or a lot of mammals, there are receptors for body clocks on skin, on feathers. Light sets time for almost all of terrestrial biology. And the same thing is true of us. We can use light boxes, which are simulated sunlight, to shift all of our internal clocks.
Well, let's talk a little bit about where we started in terms of how light sets time in our daily lives, jobs, things we're good at, drugs, work, sex.
Okay. Well, let's start with something like drugs. Light basically is setting up our standard 24-hour rhythms, and most of the time, unless we're in dark caves, we're really going to have enough light to set those rhythms. It turns out that drugs have different effects in the same people at different times. For example, alcohol at midnight will have 2 to 3 times the effect of alcohol at 6 p.m. And that causes a lot of trouble, because a lot of people think they've only had 1 or 2 drinks at night and there's no trouble, when in fact if they have them at 1, 2 in the morning, it may be the equivalent of having 3 or 6 or 9 drinks. Similarly, aspirin has a different effect at different times of day. If you give it to people at night, there's much less gastric side effects than if you give it to people in the morning. Blood pressure pills, we're most vulnerable to stroke and heart attack in the morning, yet a lot of people take their pills after the time of greatest vulnerability. And unfortunately, a large part of medical people just don't know this stuff. They also don't know that diagnostic tests change depending on time of day.
So on blood pressure pills, for instance, you would suggest that a person who needs to take them when they wake up as opposed to when they go to bed?
It depends on the type of pill. If the pill is timed, if it has time release, it may make perfect sense to take it at night so that as the body prepares, usually the last part of rapid eye movement sleep for wakefulness, that you have the protection you need. It's the speed, to some extent, of the increases in blood pressure, in platelet stickiness, and heart rate that occur right before we awake. And 6 to 11 really is the peak time for heart attacks across the country. And on Monday morning, the rates go up about 5 times. And one of the reasons for that is that we tend to violate our body clocks over the weekends. We go to bed late on Friday and Saturday nights, get up late, and Sunday comes, and got to change around again to get up for work in the morning. And there's 5 times the death rate on Monday morning as would be predicted. So, as I say, it affects almost everything we do. For example, sex. Some men have a lot of trouble getting erect. And it turns out that testosterone peaks during rapid eye movement sleep. It peaks 3, 4, 5 times a night. So some people who have been having trouble in the daytime, if you wake up, oh, 30, 40 minutes before your normal wake time and your partner knows about it and is looking forward to it, very often people will have a very different sexual experience, a very pleasant one.
And that, again, is related to the sleep and the rapid eye movement.
Yeah, rapid eye movement sleep is just one part of sleep. If we could remember what we do in sleep, sleep would probably represent a whole different series of consciousness. Deep sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, are completely different from wakefulness in terms of how our brain works and how our body works. And if we were to actually remember what we did, we'd probably find ourselves not leading one life, but two or three or four.
So how does a person begin or become able to remember?
If you want to remember dreams, and usually the more complex dreams occur in rapid eye movement sleep, the trick is to wake up during them and record them. If people can just record dreams, or if they find they can't remember anything, just wake up maybe 20 or 30 minutes earlier than they usually do and see if they can come up with some dream material. The brain tends to remember it more and more, and people can actually change their dream life. Some people do it to make themselves more creative.
Can you tell us what dreams represent in our lives?
Oh, that's a huge philosophical discussion.
That's why I ask.
I think that dreams have meaning and at the same time are also very important physiologic processes. It turns out that when we go into rapid eye movement sleep, when we go into really complex dreams, our brains are totally different. Some parts of them are turned on fully. Other parts are turned off. And what the brain is trying to do is make sense out of having only partial information. And that's when we create all these wonderful things we call dreams. And for example, people will fly in dreams very commonly. And the reason is that our position sense, our ability to put ourselves in three-dimensional space, just doesn't get turned on during rapid eye movement sleep. So we find ourselves moving from Paris to New York to Sonoma County from morning to day all of a sudden, or flying or moving all around the world. And that's because parts of the brain simply aren't working. I think dreams involve meaning, they involve our histories, they involve what we remember, but they also involve basic processes. And it turns out that dreams are important to learning and memory. When you sleep-deprive kids, they don't learn as well. When you sleep-deprive undergraduates, they don't learn as well. And part of the reason is that they don't get enough rapid eye movement sleep. We need that for memory. We need that for learning.
I'd like to take a moment and say that we're talking with Dr. Matthew Edlund, the author of a recent book called The Body Clock Advantage, Finding the Best Time of Day to Succeed in Love, Work, Play, and Exercise. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Matthew, you talk about partial information. The partial comes because it's what each individual sees or learns or absorbs in lifetime?
Well, when I'm talking about partial information and rapid eye movement sleep, it's just that certain parts of the brain are really active and certain parts are turned off. You could say that that's happening in wakefulness, but in general, when we're awake, most of our brains can be turned on to some extent. But when we're asleep, different things change. All our biology changes. And I think our consciousness changes, too. For example, there were experiments that were done in Washington a few years ago where they had people sleep sort of like cavemen. And they would have them sleep, 9, 10, 11 hours a night. And two things happened that were really surprising to the researchers. One, when people finished the study, they said they had never known what it was to be alert. They had never known what it was to be awake until they had taken this extra added time of really protected sleep. The second thing was that a lot of people had mystical experiences. They would find themselves waking up in the middle of the night, especially in rapid eye movement sleep, and starting to dream and sort of be awake at the same time and thinking about nature and the state of the universe. And I sometimes think that what we talk about as the mystic sense of oneness or wholeness that people have, and the kind of wholeness that's described in so-called primitive peoples, may simply be part due to the fact that people give themselves enough time to rest. We're massively sleep depriving ourselves across this population. We're sleeping 2 hours less than we did 100 years ago. It's a huge biological experiment, and I don't think it's doing us very well at all.
Why is that occurring?
Because people don't want to sleep, because they want to do other things. They want to talk on the telephone, watch television, be on the internet. Because we now live with electric lights. And electric lights, just like sunlight, change the way our body clocks work. It's because we're starting to view ourselves more as machines, I think, than as bodies, as people. If you look at biology of all organisms, you find that they're cyclic. Everything about a bear or a dolphin or a human, for that matter, is cyclic. What we're good at changes through the day. When we have good short-term memory is different in the morning than it is in the evening. How we remember a recipe is different at different times of day. But instead, we're viewing ourselves more like our machines, but somehow we're equivalent throughout the 24-hour day. We view ourselves almost like we're industrial objects, and I think that's a big mistake.
So when you say that we remember things differently during different times of the day, that would vary from person to person depending on the genetic makeup.
It varies from larks to owls. It varies with motivation. It varies with how well slept people are. There are a lot of factors that come into it. But what is clear is that there's a cyclicity to virtually all aspects of human life.
So then I presume the question would be, how can an individual determine what his or her cycle is?
Well, most of the time people have a pretty good idea whether they're morning people or night people. And if they don't, I ask in my book that they just go on vacation and see what times they're comfortable with. Do they want to go to bed at 3 o'clock in the morning, or do they want to go to bed at 9 p.m. at night? When do they feel sharp? It's a simple quiz in the Body Clock Advantage, and I think people can answer and get that answer for themselves fairly rapidly.
And once that determination is made, what are your suggestions that a person do?
Just that they start noticing their own cycles, and importantly, the cycles of the people around them, the people they live with, the people they work with, so they can find that different times they're good and the different times they're not, and they can be more in sync. For example, even with extreme larks and extreme owls who are working together, there are going to be times when both of them are pretty alert and pretty sharp. And if you know what those overlap times are, you can have a much, much better time. It even works in terms of sports. For example, it's still possible to predict who's going to win National Football League Monday night games based on who's flying from east to west. And when people have to change time zones a lot, they don't tend to do very well. I'm down here in Sarasota, and when the Tampa Bay Buccaneers won their conference championship, the coach immediately had them fly out to San Diego so that you wouldn't have that Monday night effect. Teams, families, workmates, we all have our different cycles, and when we start to notice what our own are and what other people's are, it can really make it easier for us to work together.
Dr. Edlin, you're talking about the importance of realizing that we each have these clocks. Tell us about that.
We're born this way. This is the basic way we're built. This is the basic way we're designed. I wrote the Body Clock Advantage because I want people to live the way their body is built. Our bodies are built on time. Everything we do is cyclic. And when people start noticing that, when they start noticing when they're doing certain things, when they feel creative, when they want to have sex, they start noticing all these cycles in their lives. And it starts changing the way they view their own body, and it starts changing the way they view the people around them. Another thing that happens is they start viewing the natural world differently. They start realizing how cyclic the natural world is, just like they are. Stop viewing themselves in terms of this industrial ethic and viewing themselves as a kind of machine to be used and gotten through the day with 20 minutes work here and 40 minutes work there.
How about applying the Body Clock Advantage to weight loss?
It turns out that for 50 years, there's been knowledge that when you eat may be as important as what, but most people don't know it. And the trick is to move calories to the morning. If you can move more of your calories to breakfast, people will tend to lose weight. If you want to gain weight, eat at night. If you give people one meal a day and give it to them in the morning, they lose weight. Give it to them in the evening, they gain weight. And there are a lot of good biological reasons for it. Another factor is sleep. When people are sleep deprived, and unfortunately most of the population is, they tend to gain weight. If we don't get enough sleep, our insulin resistance goes up. We tend to produce more insulin for the same effect. We tend to deposit more fat. We tend to be more prone to diabetes. It's a real problem in young people. I think it's one of the main reasons that adolescents are getting so much more obese. They're just not sleeping enough.
What is the effect of lack of sleep on a person's well-being or ability to do things properly, drive, work machinery, participate in perhaps, well, I hope not, an upcoming war?
It gets worse. Sleep deprivation definitely degrades performance. If people are severely sleep deprived, they don't remember well, they don't learn well, and they make a lot of mistakes. When you add to that the impact of body clock time, of what happens to us between midnight and 6 a.m., when most of us don't tend to perform very well, you can have some real disasters. You can have the Bhopals and Three Mile Islands and Chernobyl, and many of the real major industrial disasters occur between midnight and 6. If we do go to war in Iraq, we're going to engage in a night war, and unfortunately, even if you prepare people, you'll tend to have more mistakes. In my book, though, I talk about the LENS program: light, exercise, naps, socializing. Those four things can be very useful in keeping people alert and awake at night, especially when they're doing shift work.
Degrading performance by sleep deprivation, that's across the board at any age?
Yes. Fortunately, when we're young, we tend to be more resilient. The older we get, the more problems it creates. You'll find, for example, when people do shift work, that they can sort of survive shifts in their 20s, but if you get them in their 40s, it's a much harder proposition. I used to work 36-hour shifts routinely. If I had to do it now, I would just be mulch. But when I did it when I was 25, I could sort of get through it.
And you did that as part of your medical training?
Right.
So why is it that physicians are trained to have these extraordinarily long shifts when they're the ones that should know about how people work?
Do as I say, not as I do. There are many reasons for it. A large part of it is economic. If you're going to have 24-hour working conditions and people want health care 24 hours a day, it's really a lot easier to have young people who can work 100, 110 hours a week and work through the night at relatively low wages. Another impact is supposedly because doctors have to be trained to take care of people no matter how ill, sick, confused, tired they are, and just be ready under severe conditions. There's something in that. But a lot of places are recognizing now, like in New York State law, that that's a losing proposition and that people make a lot more mistakes at night. If you look, for example, at truck fatalities, you find out per trucker they go up about 40 times at night as they do in the daytime, or at least they used to. You can set up rules to change those things, but we really are very, very poor workers at night.
So you're suggesting in terms of the truck fatalities and the effect of alcohol that you were mentioning earlier, stay off the road between 1 and 6?
I think for a lot of people it's a lot safer to do so. Yes. Now, if you're a severe owl and you start to feel really alive at 1 or 2 in the morning, it may not be a problem. But for much of the population, it is. People just don't do well. And if people are having alcohol after midnight, not only would they have a higher blood alcohol level, but even at the same blood alcohol level, alcohol will have more deleterious effects than it will in the evening or day. So you've really got to watch it when you drink at night.
And those effects are reduced reaction time and reduced ability to comprehend what's going on.
And a differential in terms of how well people think they're driving. One of the big problems with alcohol is not just that people are doing worse, but they think they're doing better. They actually think that they're driving better than they are as a result of drinking. And that's one of the main reasons you have accidents like you do.
Is that true of other drugs, marijuana, for example?
I haven't studied it as much. I think with marijuana, there is something of that differential effect as well. That people, especially when their mood is high, really overestimate their ability to operate machinery.
Well, Dr. Matthew Edlund, author of The Body Clock Advantage, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask you to tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately.
I'm rereading a great Russian novel called The Master and Margarita, which was written by a man named Mikhail Bulgakov. And what's fascinating about it are a lot of things, including that it had to be published 22 years after he died, and that Stalin didn't allow him to publish for the last 10 years of his life. But what he's doing is using all kinds of different forms to create a novel. He's using satire, he's using fantasy, he's using comedy, farce, and putting it all together. He knows how to take disparate elements and make them work. And I think that's what we have to do, too. We have to use the different abilities we have, the different abilities we have at different times, and put them together in a balanced form that works for us. Everybody's got to use their body the way it's built. And what you really want to know is how your own body uniquely is built. And that's one of the main reasons I wrote that book.
Dr. Matthew Edlund, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you.
Dr. Matthew Edlund is the author of The Body Clock Advantage, Finding Your Best Time of Day to Succeed in Love, Work, Play, and Exercise. The book he recommends is The Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious are available for $10 each. I'll give you the address in just a moment. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your cards, letters, suggestions, and ideas for future programs. Here's the address. Radio Curious, Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541. And the email is curious@pacific.net. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel.